Okay, the bitter end. For those of you, and at least there were not too many on my side, who submitted formative essays or outlines, you'll get the feedback this week. I think there are only three of you who did that on my seminar. I realize you're not required to do it, but So the point is, don't worry, there won't be too many for me to look at to get you the feedback. Okay, and also in the third term, there will be a review session. Ralph and I will each have review sessions, and we will do them on different weeks. Yeah.
Do you have any idea about when you found
it? No. No, in fact, we're not planning the review sessions till we know this. So that was my next point. but it'll probably be within the first 3 weeks of the third term. There will be two review sessions, right? One from him and one from me. We in the past, we've talked about doing them both on the same day, but I don't think that quite fits the way we operate. So there'll be two of these things. But we can't tell you anything yet. But it's usually toward the end of this month that the preliminary exam schedule comes out, and then at that point we'll make our plans. Let's see what else. I guess that's it for the time being. What we're going to end on here. I mean, I realize that as the weeks have gone on, we've been just moving into crazier and crazier terrain here with regard to what the law covers. And so last week we were talking about animals and animal citizenship and all of that with Zoopolis. And I want to put Zoopolis back on the board here because you'll see in a few minutes that there is another way in which this kind of idea applies. But what I want to move now, if you recall, I put this conference report that took place on non-human personhood at Yale back at the end of 2014, I think it was, or 13, and there we were looking at not only human rights but animal rights and machine rights. And so I'm going to move to machine rights today. And the first thing to say in terms of the models, because when we were talking about animal rights last week, it became clear, one kind of model for animal rights, and this is where the author of the Zoopolis book, Kimlicka, is coming from, right, is to think about animals as something like, you might say, indigenous peoples, right, people who have kind of cultural or group rights, and to think about the species rights of animals along those models, where there needs to be some kind of dedicated space, dedicated terrain, for just those people, and the understanding is, in some sense, they need to have a kind of integrity of their own without interference from the outside. Okay, and so there are a lot of the discussion of indigenous people's rights have this kind of character as well. And in fact, this is kind of where Kimlicka, the author of the Zoopolis book, was coming from, trying to extend this kind of idea. And so typically, when one talks about kind of a legal protection of animals as animal rights, one thinks about the idea of a sanctuary, right, that is away from human beings. Now, in the case of machines, we're talking about something different, okay? And it's a very interesting difference, and it's the idea, and this gets us to a very important part of the story, the Turing test. The Turing test is named after the mathematician Alan Turing, who you may know was very much involved in breaking codes, Nazi codes, during World War II. There have been movies made about this guy. But he's also known for having constructed this thing called the Turing test, which is a kind of an intelligence test based on the ability of computers to simulate human beings, right, to such an extent that you can't tell the difference between them in the way they answer, okay? This kind of test was, in fact, started to get implemented, actually, as a kind of challenge for artificial intelligence way back in the 1950s and 60s. And in fact, one of the areas where it was very important was in psychiatry. So one of the first kinds of forms of artificial intelligence, a very primitive form, was a kind of, you know, question-led psychiatric encounter, right? Where, in a sense, you know, you would say you have a problem, and you would put in, you know, what's bothering you and what you think, and then the computer would give you a response. Now, the interesting thing was that, you know, the computer could be programmed to respond in certain ways based on the typical, you know, appropriate psychiatric diagnoses of various kinds of symptoms that the patient is presenting. And so you could program a computer to do that. It would be basically a mechanical object independently responding to the questions without a human being present. Now the thing is that humans, however, the way they interpreted this event back in the 1960s was actually they thought they were communicating with a human being through the computer. Right? So they thought it was like kind of email, right? This is what they thought they were doing. But in fact, it was the machine itself that was generating the answers. Okay? And insofar as people believe they were actually dealing with a human psychiatrist, this program, and the name of the program, by the way, was ELIZA. Excuse me, ELIZA, you can look it up. Insofar as this, that people were convinced by what this program said, as in some sense addressing their psychiatric problems, it was regarded as a success, right? So it passed the Turing test, right? People didn't think they were dealing with a computer, but they were dealing with a computer, right? It wasn't just a screen, you know, through which they were communicating. That was actually the thing doing it. And so this, of course, gave a lot of encouragement to people to develop artificial intelligence. And the thing, of course, about artificial intelligence, which you know, sometimes doesn't impress people too much about it, is the fact that it usually has very limited powers to change its own program, right? So in other words, while it can be, you know, while you can program a machine to, as it were, anticipate most of the situations the machine will encounter, so it can answer all the questions it's likely to get, okay? And you know, and it has the kind of protocols, but protocols that human beings have too, to say, can you reformulate the question, right? I mean, real people say that too to other people. It's not like we always understand what people are saying the first time around, so we get people to reformulate stuff. Well, a computer can do that too, right? Can ask you to reformulate until it actually hears what it's supposed to, you know, one of the things it's ready to hear. Okay, but that's a pretty limited mode of interaction, right? And so people don't usually consider that to be the gold standard of artificial intelligence. Because basically, what the machine can do is pretty much set by the program. The interesting question is when the machine can actually change its own program. Okay? And it can kind of reorganize itself. And so in a sense, you know, usually from the experience that it's had, it can draw certain conclusions. You know, so for example, let's say we go back to ELIZA, the psychiatric program, right? It encounters many different patients, and it begins to see that there are symptoms that the patients have, right, which in a way are correlated in certain ways, and this may lead ELIZA to start to think that there's a different kind of disease that's actually going on that the ELIZA was not originally programmed to catch. And so ELIZA itself invents a new disease, as it were, to capture it. That would be an example of the machine kind of learning, as it were, and reconstituting itself. Okay? And of course, the goal of artificial intelligence is to enable this capacity to the maximum extent so that a machine, in principle, could radically reprogram itself, could really upgrade itself, wouldn't always require human input for upgrading. Okay? And at that point, of course, then the machine would be fully autonomous. It would actually live up to that kind of gold standard. Right? So not only would we not be able to distinguish its response from a human being, but it would actually have a human-like capacity doing it, right? Namely, this capacity to reprogram, reconstruct one's thinking, and so forth. And that's the goal of artificial intelligence. Now, you know, so I've told you this little story. Now, one of the interesting things about the story is that this is a story which involves computers very much in the human world. This is not a story about putting computers in sanctuaries. Okay? It is about computers, in a sense, over time, being trained up. And as it were, growing in their autonomy through their interactions with people. to such an extent that the people no longer actually need to intervene, right, in their makeup in any direct way in order for them to fully function in a human world. Right? Because we're using a human standard to judge the machine performance. And this would be ultimate success in artificial intelligence, a kind of full autonomy, where we don't even have to worry about machine, you know, we don't have to worry about upgrading the machines to catch up with us, because the machines will upgrade themselves, and in certain cases, what they come up with may mean we will have to catch up with them. So that's autonomy for you, okay? And this is an autonomy that's accomplished in the human world through interaction with human beings, where the difference between the human and the machine from the standpoint of performance is minimized. Of course, the machine may look different and all the rest of it, but nevertheless, from the standpoint of competent social interaction, machine's doing fine. Okay? This dynamic that we're talking about here is very different from the kind of dynamic that is portrayed for animal rights, where the tendency is to want to segregate the animals, not to integrate them. And this is why somebody like Kimlicka is kind of interesting, because when you start to talk about ideas of citizenship, then there is a notion of integration implied. Right? Because what Kimlicka wants to do is to go beyond simply providing sanctuary for animals, but what he wants to do is to provide kind of a new form of thinking about society, kind of an ecological notion of society, where the animals and the humans have specified rights and obligations toward each other. So that does imply interaction. But, you know, and then the question becomes, to what extent would you need to change the animals in order for this to happen? And so we talked a little bit about uplift and all this other kind of stuff. And that would push us more in the direction that is already the case with the machines. Because the machines, the way, when people talk about android rights, as it's often called, right, or cyborg rights, and there is an interesting difference between these two things, right, we're talking about autonomy. Autonomy is the gold standard for rights. It's beyond protection. Now, I want to say something about the difference between androids and cyborgs. Both of them involve artificial intelligence to a certain extent, but the android is a freestanding autonomous being. Okay? And so, for example, one talks about the possibility, and they're already being created, android companions. Android companions are basically these, in fact, this is one, they're two main kind of contexts in which androids are being developed these days, okay, and which propel android research. One is android companions, and these are like substitute, like nursing, you know, care for, you know, nursing care for the home, this kind of thing. So old people can live in their own homes, and they have these companions, these androids, learn how the old person speaks and it becomes acquainted with the old person and is sophisticated enough in the way it can process information that it can actually anticipate the needs of the old person and be able to live with them and provide some kind of companionship, actually. Talk to them, all the rest of it, okay? That is a big area, and of course that has a lot to do with the aging population and the fact that we have very limited beds and rooms for putting old people, right? So you want to keep them in their homes. And so the way you keep them in their homes is you give them an android companion. So that's big business now, okay? They're making androids for that reason. The other reason, of course, is android warfare, okay? Possibility of, drone warfare, all this kind of stuff. That's also another area which is not quite on stream yet. It's very controversial. Because so much of our notions of warfare is tied to the idea of the dignity of the human being, right? And the extent to which what happens if you have an android warrior, right, doing something that ends up killing a lot of human beings, right? This is very tricky. Who's exactly responsible at this point? What does responsibility mean? And so this is a much trickier matter, but that's another area where the android technology is being developed. And the point is, in both cases, we're talking about agents, artificial intelligent agents that are different from human beings. They are clearly different. Now, cyborgs is a trickier issue, okay? And I put on the reading for this week this policy paper that came out from the Brookings Institution in Washington, which is a kind of left of center think tank. And a cyborg is different, right? Because a cyborg involves a kind of hybridization of the human and the machine. Okay? So, for example, our friend Stephen Hawking, right? Who, without all the technological gizmos, would be just an ordinary quadriplegic who wouldn't be able to communicate at all and probably not live very long. Okay? But with all of this apparatus that he has all over him, right, the man's a genius. Okay? And so we've got this thing here of cyborgs. So they already exist. And to a certain extent, you know, one could say that, you know, those of us who wear glasses, you know, we've got this cyborg moment going on, right? People have people have brain chips, right? But the interesting thing, if you read this policy paper, was this law case, right? Riley versus California, right? Where the police were not allowed, this is according to the United States Supreme Court, this is the United States Supreme Court decision, Riley versus California, 2014, right? What does the Supreme Court say? And the Supreme Court, keep in mind, is at the moment, at least at the time this decision was taken, was dominated by conservatives. Conservatives had a majority of 5-4. Right? Scalia's dead now, so it's up in the air, but it was 5-4 back when this was going on. And the thing was, the police do not have the right to search a smartphone because that is a violation of personal privacy. In other words, your smartphone's part of you. Right? Police cannot seize the smartphone. Like they might do for property. Now that's pretty amazing. Okay? And so and in the decision, it was said that the reason for this is because the smartphone is so integral to the human existence, right, that we should treat it as an extension of the human body. Even though it is obviously not glued onto you in any way, it is a separate object, but nevertheless, its relationship to you is so intimate that it can be considered part of your proper person. Now that is interesting, okay? That's the first time anyone's ever done that kind of thing. The Supreme Court's done this. And so this then opens the door, right? In terms of what do we think a person is, a human being even is. That a human being need not be, first of all, human being need not be solely Homo sapiens, right? And moreover, the human being doesn't even need to be kind of like Stephen Hawking, which is to say, someone who began as a Homo sapiens, but now got a lot of cyborg bits in them. A human being could also be a distributed object. Right? Part of me is here, and the other part's on the smartphone. And it's all me, from a legal standpoint. Equally me, both bits. Okay? So we have Supreme Court precedent in the United States on this point. And this is where we get to cyborg rights, okay? And the question is whether cyborg rights are the same thing as human rights. Because if cyborg rights are the same thing as human rights, then basically we are redefining what a human being is in terms of the paradigm case of a human being. Paradigm case of a human being at the moment is a freestanding, able-bodied, right, Homo sapiens. And all of the exceptions are made around that as the paradigm case. But now we're talking about a situation where various kinds of pieces of technology on which you are heavily dependent and maybe independent of your physical body, nevertheless may be constitutive of your personhood. Okay? And so these guys at the Brookings Institution are arguing this is the thin edge of the wedge, right? That in a sense, we are really opening up the door to a consideration of cyborgs. And so this is a trickier issue, right? Because with the androids, that is a freestanding mechanical entity. And so in a sense, you know, what you're doing there is talking about enfranchising another kind of entity into the category of rights. Just like you could enfranchise animals, you can enfranchise machines. But when we start to define the human itself as having these machine parts, we're entering into a kind of strange zone. Okay? And so what they say in this report is that they look at examples where these issues are already with us in a sense. So there is something called cyborg rights movement. Okay, you can look that up. And so they talk a bit about this guy, Neil Harbison. Has anyone ever heard of this guy? Okay, so this guy, Neil Harbison, was born colorblind, radically colorblind, okay? However, he got implanted into his head, and it looks, and I've met this guy, I've been on panels with this guy, it looks like a kind of thing an insect would have, okay? What he can do is he can hear colors. Because his hearing is great, and he's a musician, actually. And the thing is that, so the colors end up being understood by him as sound. Okay? And because he's got this apparatus stuck on his head, right, the apparatus makes the translation, so he can actually move around the world pretty well. In fact, he can actually make all kinds of distinctions with regard to color that we cannot do, but through sound. Okay? And when you speak, and if you, you know, when he speaks, I mean, he's a perfectly decent, very articulate guy, you can look him up, and you know, there he is standing on the stage with this antenna.
Is it stuck in his head?
Yeah. It's in the skull. And in fact, when he was at a political rally, I think it was in Spain or something, and police thought he was actually recording, that he was actually recording the rally, and so they broke the thing off. And that was grievous bodily harm. And so, for example, he had a hard time, in terms of getting passport photos, right? Because, with passport photos, you've got to take off everything. And they wanted him to take that off. But he says, no, that's part of me. Okay? So this guy, because this is a very common way in which these things happen, right? In other words, how you become a cyborg. It starts off as a kind of disability corrector, right? So you have a disability, and the disability provides the opportunity because, again, I think I may have mentioned this in the class, that because of the very strict ethical regulations on doing experiments on human subjects, very often, the only way in which you can, above board, engage with these kind of radical technological enhancements we're talking about is when the subject starts off disabled. And then in some sense, you can present it as restoring senses, restoring capacities that the subject would not have otherwise had. So that actually opens the door, from the legal standpoint, for you to do all kinds of wild, funky things to this disabled person. And they end up then with magical powers, which is the case with Harbison, okay? And of course with Stephen Hawking, right? It's the same deal. And so what happens then, of course, is once you have these new technological enhancements put into these people who start off as disabled, and you see how they work, and you see they work pretty well, that then this can start to provide some kind of, model, as it were, or inspiration to then see what could we do to normalize this. Okay? Because here's the thing, right? And it's one of the things that Harbison plays around. Harbison's a very smart guy. You should watch one of his videos. I've experienced this because I've been on panels with this guy. When he explains exactly how his antenna works and how he's translating, all of these light waves into sound and how he's then able to produce all this very funky music as a result. So he does shows and stuff this way, right? And all he's doing is just channeling his senses. People in the audience want this. Okay? This is the interesting thing, right? So in other words, there become, when people see this, they say, oh, that's cool, I'd like an antenna. Right? And somebody says, well, no, you can't get that unless you're disabled, actually. Your senses are perfectly fine. Lay off. But this is not how people, you get a lot of people actually, and this is true with a lot of these kind of more advanced form of prosthetics and enhancements, that we see the disabled people have. And of course, as the disabled people, you know, are restored and look perfectly fine and are doing very interesting things and have a very strong public presence, which is what we're seeing now, of course, you know, from the Paralympics to everything, right? You actually start to get people who do start to say, why can't this be made available to everyone? Why do only disabled people have the fun? Okay? And so this is what this policy report is considering, right? It's considering this kind of, you know, change in the way people look at things. Because it's quite a, in a sense, what we're seeing, you know, is a kind of a shift, a very subtle shift, you know, in terms of what counts as normal human existence. Because so much, right, of the way the law works in terms of how law makes judgments about things, right? We talk about what it is reasonable for people to do, what is reasonable for people to expect, right? What is appropriate in terms of one's ability to act in the world and all the rest of it. All of these things involve a lot of intuitions about what does it mean to be normal as a human being? Okay? And so the point here is with the greater prominence of the cyborgs about us, okay, people's intuitions are shifting. Okay? People's intuitions are shifting. And then the question becomes, how does the law deal with this, right? And so the business with the smartphone being seen as part of you, right? One of the reasons why the Supreme Court didn't feel any problem in saying that the smartphone was an extension of you was because they see how people respond to the smartphone. They understand the role of the smartphone in people's lives. Maybe some of these Supreme Court justices have lost their smartphones and have felt they lost a hemisphere of their brain, right? You know, I mean, this could happen. And so this kind of shift is really quite important. So but the question is, what are we talking about when we talk about cyborgs then? Are we talking about an extension or even maybe a shift in what it means to be human in terms of, you know, which would be relevant for discussing what it is to have human rights? Or are we talking about a new class of rights that in some sense might be between human and android? Okay? And that's the tricky thing, right? How to actually explain, because at the moment, of course, unless you are disabled, you are generally not eligible for any of this stuff that is now made to appear so attractive to people. And people somehow think they should have the right to this. And so part of what the policy report does is to kind of consider, okay, you know, what exactly do people have the right to under the circumstances, right? Do you have the right to enhance, to be enhanced? Okay. And it's a very fraught issue. There's no obvious answer to it, but I think it's going to be one that's going to be, you know, increasingly asked, especially when people, you know, when you start getting these kind of court case rulings. Yeah.
With enhancement, I wouldn't say we've got all that far, especially if you're going to talk about enhancement in terms of sports competitions, though, as well. The idea that prosthetics are actually improving athlete's ability more than the actual capable human body. So in that way you can say that everyone's going to be able to get, if they either want enhancement, it would not be legalized in some cases.
What do you mean, it would or would not be legalized?
It would not. Well, at the moment, if it could change, would everyone be allowed to have enhancements, but it still have to be like on a fair grounding of everyone.
Right, right. So you're talking in the sports world. No, I agree. And I think, in a sense, the sport, because, you know, again, we can start talking, you know, when we talk about cyborgs, we are normally thinking about putting up like a piece of technology on you somehow, or somehow relating you to technology. But of course, if we're talking about, you know, sports enhancement, where people are primarily taking drugs, you know, then that also would fall under this, right? I mean, so the idea of, you know, enhanced performance through drug taking. I personally think that it's going to be very hard to maintain the line on this. In other words, that there's a sense in which if it turns out that there's enormous numbers of athletes who are taking drugs for enhancement, and, you know, and that the fact, you know, as you know, Sharapova's just gotten the news, and all Lance Armstrong, all kinds of people, But they're sort of found out accidentally, right? I mean, one gets the feeling that there might be a lot more of this that's on the horizon. I think it's going to be a very difficult issue. It's going to be a very difficult issue to solve. But it is true, right, that in the history of sports itself, certain forms of enhancement have been allowed in terms of the kind of gear that people wear when they're engaged in sports and stuff like that, which has changed abilities to perform and so forth. So certain forms of enhancement have been fairly accepted, but the ones that have involved drug taking have been the problematic ones. Okay, there is going to, I recommend a book if you're interested in how this kind of the doping in sports plays into the cyborg thing. There's a book that's going to be coming out in the summer, I recommend, called Edge. And it's by Roger Pilkey. Okay? And he's a guy who originally comes out of science policy. And, you know, because this is, I think, going to be an area, I think you've raised a good point, that this is going to be an area where a lot of this stuff is going to end up getting played out in the long term. You know, and who knows, one resolution, if you're the sort of person who likes the idea of cyborg rights as different from human rights, you might have a kind of category of sport for enhanced athletes, so you could put all the Lance Armstrongs and Sharapovas in kind of one category and let them battle it out, and then you have the unenhanced people, right? And then you could have a third category for the very radically enhanced, like Oscar Pistorius or somebody like that, right? You know, so you could start to make these kinds of gradations if you were so inclined, okay? But I do think these issues are going to become more and more important. And so this is, see, what's interesting about this, I think, from the standpoint of our, is that this is not just simply an issue of expanding the legal circle or the moral circle as it was in the case of the animals, but this is a case where the expansion kind of calls into question what the core concept is, right? What is the core concept of human, right, to which we would want to attach rights once we start to get into all these enhancement possibilities, okay? Let me get a sense from the class here. I mean, how many of you believe that this tendency that we're going on now, whereby we're expanding the human so that it includes, let's say, the smartphone is part of you, and as it were, Stephen Hawking still counts as a human being, right? I mean, that kind of expanded notion of human, where it actually includes technological objects, some of which may be detached from the human body. How many of you are on board with this? Because this is kind of where the law is going at the moment. None of you are on board with this? You don't like this idea? I mean, but does anyone like this idea?
I agree that your phone is like your personal property, but to say it's a part of you, I don't think that's correct.
Well, it's sufficiently. Obviously, your phone in one sense is property, and that's if someone stole it, right? That you could sue for it or whatever. But here, it's a stronger claim, right? It's not just it's like part of your person.
Yeah, I don't think it's part. I mean, it's not. It's like it's a piece of property.
Until potentially you can get wearable tech or technology that's more integrated to the person, a phone as something that's like, it's still just property, it's not part of you.
Just because it's not attached to you. That's your criteria, it has to be attached to you.
Well, some physical form of attachment would help.
Well, I mean, you are actually an intermittent attachment with the phone as you pick it up and put it down, right? I mean, it's not like the phone exists completely independently of you. Right, I mean, but okay, yeah.
I don't think it needs to be part of you, physically part of you, to be part of yourself. I mean, it records so much information about yourself, and it has so many memories of yourself. And they might be able to use social media on their phones all the time, and it's got memories and your contacts, and it's always taking information about you. So, I think it's part of us more than people realize.
Okay, so you're on board with what the Supreme Court did. You thought that was the right move.
So it's part of your identity, especially with anything, not just the phone, but your own property, and within any prosthetic limbs you may have, it's can be like part of how you see yourself in that sense. But I think a part of criteria for seeing what is human is if you could take it away from you, would that remove your humanity? And I don't think that would be.
Well, this well, no. Remember, when people look what happens when people lose these things. right? It is a, it's like a, it's a real blow to the system for a lot of people.
Wouldn't you just argue that it's more of a tool that we use a lot instead of saying that it's a part of you, though? Because, like, just because it holds your photos doesn't mean, like, if I have a camera and I take pictures and take memories with that, I'm not going to say that's a part.
Well, people do a lot with a smartphone, actually. I mean,
they do. I just wouldn't, personally, I don't, like, when I think about myself, I'm not like, yeah, well, my phone's part of my identity, it's me, it's mine, I'm part of it, we're the same, like, never, ever. I wouldn't think that. Like, I use it every day, every single moment, but I wouldn't consider it part of me. Like, that's just my personal
opinion. Well, what about your laptop? I mean, do you have any, because sometimes with a laptop, people, I know, you know, you have, like, your writing, whatever you've been working on, you know, the stuff that kind of is very much part of what you do as a human being. Is there, kind of stored. And supposing that were to disappear or get erased or something like that, wouldn't that be serious damage?
It would, but as in, that's like, if it was the only thing I could use to, like, write my thoughts down, then that would be a really problem, but I have a...
But what if you already had a lot of thoughts and they get erased?
That's true, it'd be problematic, but I wouldn't say it's a problem at the same time.
But look, I mean, but again, when we talk about the integrity of the human being, right, you know, one of the things that... When let's say I were to torture you, right? This is not a good thing to do. You're not allowed to do this under human rights law. When I torture you, you can recover from torture, right? People do that all the time, right? But they're still tortured. It is still a bad thing. It still causes them a lot of grief, okay? Well, this is the level at which one might think about the erased laptop. You see, this is the level at which to think about it, right? If you think about what constitutes violations of human rights... When is your dignity as a human being violated? It doesn't follow that, you know, the only time your human rights are violated is when you're dead, when you're killed, right? There's a lot of other kinds of things that can be done to you short of killing you that constitute the violation of human rights. And I think that's the, because what you're arguing is, sure, you know, all my thoughts may be erased, but I'll have new thoughts and all of that.
Yeah, maybe, perhaps. I mean, I don't know. I don't have any arguments back. Like,
No. I just want you to. I guess all I'm trying to do here. I'm not trying to persuade you of anything necessarily. But what I want you to do is, I want you to see the vividness of the claim. Okay, that this is not such a stupid claim in a way. That what the Supreme Court said is not so stupid. Yeah.
But then, so say if you were in a torture room and, okay, like, if someone was there and they were deleting my files, I could just watch them, see them. I couldn't control it. They would delete my files one by one. It would just be annoying. But like, it would have been like, oh my god, like, I'm dying.
So someone could delete all your files, and you just sort of sit there and say, oh, you're just an asshole, but you wouldn't go further than that. That would be as far as you'd go.
Yeah, I would probably be annoyed, yeah, like, you're annoying, but it's not like... They've gone against what it means for me to be a human. They've, like, physically injured me. They've caused me an large amount of grievous pain.
You don't believe that? You don't think so? No. What do people think about? How many people agree with him on that point?
I wouldn't mind if someone was leaving my files, but if they were, like, physically, like, torturing me,
they're pulling your fingernails off. Like, that's
upset, yeah. I feel like that's a lot harsher.
Okay, so, okay, yeah.
But say if it depends what you value on there. I mean, I don't know how far I class it as torture, but say if I finished an immaculate essay and someone deleted it the day before giving it in, then I think that'd be I'd be very angry. I think that could be some kind of emotional damage there. Not long-lasting at all, by any extent, but I can see the way...
That's just because it's only one essay. But what about every time you wrote an essay?
that could actually have a very lasting impact. You've got no power to change that.
Yeah.
I can see that happening.
Yeah, you...
I'm just interested in what you think about how cloud computing will affect this, because that's everything stored, like...
Well, that's why everybody's so frightened about that, right? Right? There is so much cybersecurity concern over that, right? Because if everybody does store their stuff up there as the primary thing, thinking it's always going to be available, then all you need is someone to capture that.
Yeah, because I think of that as the extension, not like a physical phone or a laptop, but that memory, I guess, is the thing that can be seen as part of you.
I agree, but I think that, but there's an enormous amount of cybersecurity concern over getting people to think that way, because people are then, as it were, entering into a pretty high risk zone. Everybody's pooling all the stuff that's important, all their data, into this one nebulous place, right, which is at the moment secure, but were it to be targeted, right, it could cause a lot of damage, right? Because the idea is somehow to, somehow it's meant to be safer. Initially it was said, meant to be certainly easier to access than having it on a stick or on a particular piece of machinery. But that's an open question. But the point is the potential for damage is even bigger there. That's what I would say. But I do think, insofar, because maybe we're only in the early stages of this. But one of the things that I think is true is that more and more of our lives are getting digitally encoded. Not just pictures, but writing and lots of other things too, right? In terms of what constitutes our identity. And if those things were eliminated, so like biometric data, if that were eliminated, right? All of this stuff, the idea of erasing people, right? You see this sometimes in the movies. That becomes increasingly possible in a way. And so I think this is part of what is behind the Supreme Court's thinking on this, that we're kind of at the beginning of a period where we're in fact where our personhood is getting increasingly distributed. And so the issue then is how do you police that properly so that we are not being violated? And so all the discussion about privacy, right? The privacy stuff that's becoming very big now in cyberspace is part of that discussion as well. Right? Where does your privacy end? And so it's a tricky issue. I think we're just kind of in the early stages of it. I want to give you one more example because it's another case, and this is a case that came up in this country, which again you may find unbelievable, but in a way gives you a sense of the way in which the legal definition of our personal identity is being extended. So there was this couple in Exeter, and they met each other in Second Life. That game, Second Life, right? Yeah. They met each other in Second Life, and they got married in real life. Okay, and then the woman catches the guy's avatar having an affair in Second Life. She files for divorce. She wins. Okay? Now you see what's going on here, and this happened in this country. And the idea here was that when the judge looked at the case and looked at who these people were and where, as it were, the locus of meaning in their lives were, where did the important stuff happen as far as they were concerned? It was happening in Second Life. That Second Life is an extension of real life. Yeah.
Do you have the case name at all?
I don't have it off the top of my head, but it was about 5 or 6 years ago. Since I have written about this in a book, I can probably find the reference and send it to you. So I don't know, I'll put that on email to you when I upload the lecture. Yeah, because it got a lot of publicity when it came out. And so the idea here is, right, that part of your, In, at least in this case, because of the nature of the two people involved, right? Because people get, people play Second Life to varying degrees of intensity, right? But these guys were really intense players of the game, right? They met that way. Everything, they were like in front of it all the time, right? And they actually were much more attractive looking people in Second Life than they were in real life. We could add that to the equation. So this is what we're talking about here. And the judge sees all this. And so the judge says that this is part of the real world, right? And so it is as if the husband were having an affair in the real world, okay? And so she gets the divorce. Now, how many of you think that was good? How many of you would go for that decision? You'd make that decision? You would?
Yeah.
You would? Yeah. Infidelity, of course.
Wait, so he didn't, so the affair was online?
Yes. Yes.
So what did he do? Just message her? Say, hey, I like you.
No. Second, you know what Second Life is like. Second Life is you got the simulated society. Right? Where people are avatars.
Oh,
Oh, like physical.
Yeah. So there, like the Sims, you know, Sim City, this kind of stuff, right? So you construct these avatars who usually don't look anything like you, right? But they're usually really, you know, they're kind of the, your fantasy person, right? And they go about the world doing stuff. That you can have economies based on these things. So people spend a lot of time on this stuff. Yeah, so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about one avatar having an affair with another avatar, which the wife saw. God knows what was going on there that she saw, right? Because that's another question. What exactly was what was the cyber evidence that was brought to bear here? But that's the situation. Okay, now, so the point is the guy doesn't deny anything, right? He doesn't deny that he did any of this, right? So that's not the issue. There's nothing about that, right? It's, you know, he and I guess his lawyer just didn't believe that this could be grounds for divorce. So what do you think? So now this is really important, right? Because in a sense, in terms of, you know, how do you define what is, you know, your person, you know, what is meaningful for your life as a person? What is to be counted as an extension of your personhood? If you're spending most of your time animating your avatar in Second Life, and that's kind of where your action is as far as meaning in life, that avatar is you. You agree?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's about where you personally derive meaning in your own life. If it was extremely important to them,
Okay. So this is good. This is the 21st century, people. This is where we're moving. So you be careful when you're messing around in cyberspace. You know, I mean, you better watch out. Especially if all this stuff is being recorded and people can play back and all the rest of it. Well, you know, I mean, and there are other aspects of this too that in a way have been discussed more openly, and that is because these simulated worlds actually have their own kind of commerce and rules and laws and stuff like this, there is already a discussion about how does that stuff relate to the stuff in the normal world, okay? What you know about Bitcoin? You familiar with Bitcoin? Which is a kind of simulated currency in a way, is kind of one of these areas where it's a kind of gray zone. It's a kind of like almost like a cyborg currency, you might say, you know, which actually has a translation value into real money, even though it exists entirely in cyberspace. Okay, and so there may be actually more of this kind of stuff going on in the future, where there's a kind of attempt to commensurate, right, to make comparable. What goes on in the cyber world and what goes on in the real world, to have it under a unified legal framework. So that when you're in cyberspace, you're no longer just messing around. It's no longer just play. It's part of the same legal system as you have when you're offline. Okay? And that's kind of, so that's another way in which the human identity is becoming transformed. And so, I think the way to interpret this, unless I'm mistaken, is that this involves a transformation in the definition of the human being as a legal person. Rather than saying we're talking about a different kind of being. Because nobody, you know, it's not like the law is saying, hey, you know, there's this new type of being called avatars, and they need to have their own kind of legal realm attached to them. That's not the way this is being interpreted. Okay? Rather, it's being interpreted as an extension of the human realm. So this has all kinds of implications then in terms of what's normal, what's acceptable behavior, and all the rest of it. And also, again, to add this to the mix, the extent to which people, the more time people actually spend in these sort of cyber worlds, right, the extent to which their actions there end up having feedback into their activities in the normal world. Right, so that also helps the commensuration process, right? There's a kind of sense in which people start to behave in the normal world a bit like what they do in the cyber world. This happens too, okay? And so that's gonna be part of the process that I think over time ends up kind of homogenizing the difference between the cyber world and the non-cyber world from a legal standpoint. And it's going to, I think, blur our intuitions quite substantially about what it means to be human. Okay, are there any... So we're going to... We end the module on this happy note. Are there any issues? If somebody wanted to ask a quick question, we got 1 minute to go. No? Okay. Well, look, thank you so much. And I will dig up that case and send the reference over. Okay?
Yeah.